Cropfirm, Ausgabe Nummer 423. Wir schreiben den 27. September 2019. Mein Gast heute Abend ist Thomas Vaughan Campbell und es geht um seine große Theorie von allem. Und wie immer gibt es den CropCom, jenen Live-Chat, mit dem man sich live am Gespräch heute Abend beteiligen kann. Erreichbar über die Website von CropFM, CropFM.at, CropFM.at, einfach einsteigen. Und ich gebe die Fragen sehr gerne an meinen hochprominenten Skype-Gast weiter. Und natürlich ist auch die Skype-Leitung heute wieder offen. Aber mal sehen, ob genug Zeit bleibt. Also Tom hat gemeint, er hat bis 9 Uhr Zeit. Und nachdem das ja eine große Theorie von allem ist, werden wir da, weiß nicht, ob wir da viel zu Fragen kommen, aber ich hoffe schon. Zu dieser Sendung gibt es einen Newsletter, den kann man gratis beziehen von der Startseite aus cropfm.at. Man kann mir sogar gerne mailen, cropfm@mur.at. Das Ganze erscheint als Podcast, gibt einen RSS-Feed und paar Pipapo und im Archiv kann man einzelne Ausgaben auch direkt verlinken und darüber freue ich mich natürlich, denn je mehr diese Sendung hören, desto besser und gerade das heutige Interview, ich glaube, es ist wichtig. Auch wenn es in Englisch ist und für viele anstrengend, aber es ist die Mühe wert. Ein Forum gibt es auch, betreut von Unarmed und Wingman. Das Coverbild ist eine Variante des ersten Bildes zu diesem Thema. Es zeigt meinen Gast Tom Campbell und es ist erstellt von Matthias Töpfer, atelier-töpfer.de. Da entsteht gerade übrigens auch seine neue Website und ja, wer einen Grafiker braucht, kann ich nur schwer empfehlen, dem Mann. Wenn diese Sendung gefällt, weitersagen und wer etwas beitragen möchte, kann mich mit interessanten Leuten zusammenbringen, beziehungsweise natürlich auch pekuniär spenden. Der Spendenbutton findet sich relativ weit oben auf der Startseite, geht über Überweisung, PayPal oder als Kryptowährung. Und an dieser Stelle ganz großes Danke an alle, die schon was beigetragen haben. Ja, das CropFM Lagerfeuer Nummer 3, schon heiß erwartet und am 8. November 2019 ist es soweit. Bitte jetzt schon vormerken und ich hoffe, dass wieder viele von euch dabei sind und wir interessante Stories hören. Bei den ersten beiden Ausgaben war das schon so, war wirklich toll und Sabine Zankolo und ich freuen uns schon auf das nächste Mal am 8. November. Und der Earth Strike Day, also diese Demo für die Erde, die war heute auch in Graz natürlich und es war einer der größten Demos, die ich jemals gesehen habe in Graz. Das muss ich wirklich sagen. Ich weiß nicht, ob es jetzt an einem Sonntag, ob da auch so ein Turnout gewesen wäre. Ich will das jetzt überhaupt nicht kleinreden. Es war wirklich beeindruckend, so viele sehr junge Menschen, also da waren auch waren auch Volksschulklassen irgendwie dabei und sehr viele junge Menschen da einfach zu sehen, die sich für den Erhalt der Umwelt, für die Erde und so weiter, für den Planeten einsetzen und sich darüber Gedanken machen. Das war wirklich ergreifend. Sicher gibt es viele Mitläufer und viele, die sich da gar nicht bewusst sind, was da an Einschränkungen auch irgendwo auf uns zukommt, weil so wird es sicher nicht weitergehen. Es gab wirklich gute Slogans auch, also sehr lustig fand ich, Fischers Fritz fischt heute Plastik. Leider war, dann natürlich Make Love Not CO2, aber es ging eigentlich nicht so sehr um oder ausschließlich um diese um Treibhausgase etc., sondern wirklich ganz allgemein um Umweltschutz auch und so weiter, also vor allem überwiegend eigentlich, was ich eigentlich sehr positiv fand. Einspruch war sehr seltsam, fuck me, not the planet. Weiß nicht. Vor allem im Kontext, wenn da junge Leute demonstrieren. Doch mehrdeutig, to F.. someone over bedeutet ja auch jemanden auszunutzen. Und ausgenutzt werden will, glaube ich, niemand. Beziehungsweise haben wir davon eh schon genug. Auf Ruptly gab es jetzt eine Ruptly releases new investigation of the Russian Dyatlov Pass Incident. Also eine neue Untersuchung des nach wie vor rätselhaften Vorfalls am Dyatlov Pass, der sich 1959 ereignete. Und das wurde jetzt von Ruptly veröffentlicht, sehr aufwendig digital aufbereitet. Da wird eine Menge an Originalmaterial geboten, sowie Interviews mit Wladimir Sungorkin, dem Chefredakteur der Kosmololska, Pravda, wie auch immer, eine Zeitung. Eduard Tumanov, Professor für Forensik an der Universität von Pigorov, sowie zahlreiche Ansässige und auch Augenzeugen aus der Gegend, was ich sehr spannend finde. Ziel dieser Arbeit sei, die noch immer andauernden Untersuchungen auf diese hinzuweisen. Wird offenbar natürlich noch immer untersucht, weil das Ganze ist ja noch nicht wirklich aufgeklärt. Man will den vielen Spekulationen ein Ende setzen und schließlich endlich das Schlusskapitel in dieser Saga schreiben. Ob das gelingt? Wir werden sehen. Wobei es ja dann auch immer noch ein paar geben wird, die manch einem Gerücht an einem Gerücht hartnäckig festhalten, aber das ist eh klar. Aber ja, es ist ein wirklich sehr seltsamer Vorfall und ja, vielleicht kommt man da irgendwann mal dahinter, was da wirklich mit diesen Leuten passiert ist. Ja, und hier geht's gleich weiter mit Tom Campbell. Ich freue mich unglaublich. Kaum was hat mich jemals so von den Socken gehauen. Absolut spannend. Tom Campbell's Big Toe jetzt gleich live auf Crop FM. Guest tonight is Thomas Warren Campbell, Tom Campbell, and I'm very, very honored to have him here today live. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Hi, Dirk. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great. I told you, your books, they really blew my mind. A lot of what you say is pretty disturbing, and while reading them, part of me was going like, oh no, I have to prove him wrong. I mean, I have to find something to, but I couldn't. I mean, it does make sense, and so, well, one just has to succumb to really think about what you say in these books. And you also show an astonishing sense of humor. So I don't know, should we begin the show with a couple of mind stretches, as you suggest at the beginning of book two, where you are blowing up a hallucinated spherical chicken and pretending to understand it? I mean, I was reading your book and I was really concentrated and you know, trying to get it. And then suddenly I realized that's bullshit. I mean, this, you're just making, you don't even get it, and you're in one of those, hilarious parts of the book, which really are. I had a very good laugh at a lot of places, and I think that's also a very important part of my big toe. I think to have fun, yeah.
It is indeed, and you know, when I write, the book is very dense. There's a lot of information in it, and it's the kind of stuff that makes you think very hard, and you just can't do that much of that without having a little fun in between to lighten things up. So I'm very glad that you point out the humor, because some of the humor, a lot of the humor is, anybody's humor tends to be local. You know, it has to do with things within your culture. Attitudes and ideas and things that are cultural. So humor has a hard time drifting between cultures and between languages. So I'm glad that you found it, and that there's a lot of humor in there. You have to, you know, all of this, you know, what theory of reality? You know, who are we? Why are we here? What's our point? And how does the world work? All of this needs to be taken with good humor, needs to be taken with a smile and lightly. If you work too hard at it, you'll never get it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I didn't really introduce you, because I would like you to introduce yourself. So when I was thinking about this show, I was thinking, well, where should we begin here? And then a friend of mine pointed out, well, just begin at the beginning. And that's, when you were a child, you're a physicist. You part of you is a hard-nosed applied physicist. You deal with simulations, which is of course also quite close to your theory of everything, which is also using the metaphor of simulations. Mm-hmm. But in section one, so the trilogy has six sections, three books. Each book having two sections. And in section one, you talk about the beginnings and about your childhood. And this seems to have started at a fairly young age. I mean, you describe being vetted or tested.
Yes.
Well, what was going on there?
Well, evidently, I came here with a mission to do various things, and write these books is just one of them. And you know, it's not that unusual for children. And I was, you know, 5, 6, 7, somewhere in that age when non-physical entities came to me. You know, you have lots of children with non-physical friends, you know, people they talk to and interact with, it would seem, but of course they're not physical. It's pretty common among children to have that. And I had these beings, came to me and popped me out of body, so that there I was floating in my room, you know, out of body. And they said, well, go ahead, try it out, you know, you'll slide right through the wall. And I did. And I did slide right through the wall, and I was able to use my intent to go up or down or, you know, sideways or whatever. And it was a lot of fun. So I had some fun with that, but that was just the beginning. Eventually, they taught me how I could do that on my own. And eventually, they were training me so that it wasn't just, you know, sliding around the neighborhood or so on, but actually training me in how to use the energies and the intent to get around in the non-physical. So, like I say, 5, 6, 7 years old, I started probably around 5.5 to 6, and it stopped probably somewhere around 7. So I did this for quite some time. I actually look forward to going to bed because it was so much fun. You'd go to sleep, and pretty soon you'd find yourself out floating around in the room and zipping around, having a little fun in the neighborhood, and then off to classes where, you know, I was taught to keep my intent focused and steady, and my thoughts had to be clear, and my intents had to be had to come from the being level, not from the intellect. So there's a lot of little details to getting around in the non-physical, and they just taught me, and I practiced, and eventually I got fairly good at it to where I could go where I wanted to go and do what I wanted to do. But I forgot all about that. Somewhere around 7, they said, no more. You're done. You're getting too old for this. And, you know, when you're young, everybody just kind of, you know, you have non-physical friends that come at night and so on, and everybody kind of smiles and nods, and it's okay. It's not a really big deal because it's pretty common with children. But once you get older than that, it starts to attract attention, and now people look at you and say, what's wrong with this kid? You know, he's hallucinating. So when I was about 7, they stopped. They said, no, you know, you need to grow up and not be weird. You need to grow up in a normal situation so your personality develops healthily, not in a situation where everybody's picking on you and trying to tell you that you're crazy. So I thought that was probably good, and that was the end of it. So at about 7, it disappeared. For the rest of my life, I did have contact with non-physical beings, but I kind of thought everybody did. They were just, something was there that you could always ask a question to and get an answer. You could always get the help in a bigger picture of seeing things, and I just assumed that was just the way humans were. They had this access. I never talked about it, and I just kept it to myself. But the out-of-bodies and that sort of thing disappeared, and by the time I was, you know, in college and graduate school and learning, you know, working on my master's and PhD and so on, I'd forgotten all about it. It was just way back in the past of a 7-year-old's mind. And I didn't really remember it anymore until I ran into Bob Monroe, a guy who wrote Journeys Out of the Body. And he had just built a lab where he wanted to study consciousness. And I was very ripe for that because I had just learned how to meditate in graduate school because I wanted to get by with less sleep. So I jumped at the chance to work in his lab, and he taught me what he knew about out-of-body. And after a while, about maybe 6 months or a year later, all these memories that I had from 5 to 7 all came back. And they came back because Bob Monroe triggered them, because he had some of the exact same classes, if you will, and some of the exact same experiences and tests that I did. And when he was telling them to me, they sounded very familiar, and then whoosh, all of a sudden, all of the stuff out of my past comes back. So that's how it finally got reunited. So yes, it started a long time ago when I was very young.
Yeah, that's so amazing. And you described this very vividly in section one, and I was very taken by that you were really tested. So those entities were really, it seems like they were checking you out. Is this guy the right one?
Yes, absolutely. Wow. Is this person going to be able to do what we need him to do?
Amazing.
And if the answer was no, then they were going to go work with somebody else. If the answer was yes, then they'd continue working with me. But they had their own missions and things to do. They had their own irons in the fire, and they wanted to know, was I going to be of use and be helpful or not? So I got lots of testing as I as I learned and as I grew and understood.
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit now. Okay. Not sure if you can hear
my under urine.
Okay, sorry. You were breaking up here. For some reason, the Skype. But let's see. If it doesn't work out, we can switch via phone, although Skype tells me that your phone number is not valid. Anyway, not sure what you said in the meantime. So they were checking you out, and apparently you passed the test. You described this in this book. I don't want to spoil all the book, so people should really read it. I mean, it's 820 pages of, well, life-changing experience, I would say. If you really let it close, if you just read over it, of course, but if you let this book close, it pretty much, in a good sense, messes you up, I think. And
or you could say straightens you out. That would work as well.
Yeah, maybe a better way to say it. And then you met Bob Monroe, and so he was searching for physicists who could try to actually do what you're doing, to find a theory that explains how that stuff works. Where are we when we're out of body? What happens there? Why can? And you did amazing experience where you objectively showed that people could have common experiences while they are out of body and stuff like that. So
did that several times. Yeah. Yes. Well, Bob just had these experiences happen to him, and some people do that. They just spontaneously seem to go out of body, and they find themselves, maybe floating in their room, and they can see their body lying down there sleeping, and then they learn that they can move around and pass through walls. And so the out-of-body phenomenon has been around for several hundred years, and there's a small percentage of the population that it just happens to for no particular reason. And Bob was a businessman. He had a personality like an engineer. He was very factual, very logical and precise. And these things scared him half to death when he started having these out of bodies. At first, he thought maybe he was going insane. He went to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist tested him and talked with him and said, "No, you're perfectly normal. You're just having very strange experiences. But there doesn't seem to be anything else wrong." So eventually Bob decided just to play with them and see what he could do, whether he could control them. And he found out he could control them, and he could interact, and he could find things out, and he could see things places, and then come back and check whether that really was in that place at that time. And it was. So he began to convince himself that his experience was real, because he could collect evidence. He interacted with people, saw things that were going on, which now we call remote viewing, got information that he could check. So eventually he realized, well, this is real. It's interactive with this physical world in some way. And I have a pile of evidence that says I'm really doing something here. I'm gathering information that would be impossible for me to know any other way. So at that point, he wanted to study it once he realized that it was a real thing. Then he wanted to build this lab. He was fairly wealthy. And so he built this lab, but he really didn't know what to do with it. And myself and Dennis Menrick, an electrical engineer, we just happened to run into him right about that time when he was looking for somebody to man his lab. And my job as the physicist is the theorist. How does it work? Why does it work that way? What can you do? What can't you do? And why? So that was my job, to try to figure all that out. And Dennis and I built equipment, and we were the guinea pigs. We would spend 2 and 3 hours, maybe 4 or 5 nights a week out at his lab, and he would talk to us. He would instruct us in how he went out of body. And as we did that, he could guide us, and we got some benefit of his own experience. So it helped us learn a little faster for that reason. And pretty soon I was able to do this out of body thing, to get into this alternate reality. And I had amassed, as he did, a huge pile of evidence that said this was real, things that I could do that then were evidential, were facts. So eventually I could go in and out of this state at will, pretty much whenever I wanted to and very quickly. So I started doing experiments there. I started saying, well, okay, I can collect this evidence, you know, let's say like remote viewing. I can go someplace, look at what's going on, go into some, you know, particular person's home, say, and see what they're doing at 8 o'clock in the evening. What TV program are they watching? Where was the dog lying? You know, did they have shoes on or slippers, and what color, and all those kinds of details that you just don't know. And then I could call them up on the phone and see whether or not what I saw was actually what was there. So we did that sort of evidential thing until I knew that it was real. But I found out that there's a big difference between knowing that at the intellectual level and knowing that at the emotional level. At the intellectual level, very quickly, we had enough hard evidence to convince anyone that it was real. There was probably one in a, you know, 10 million that we were just really good guessers, that we could tell, you know, what was going on in particular places just by guessing. That was obviously not what was going on. We were getting real information. But knowing that it was real intellectually was just a shadow of knowing that it was real emotionally. And I got to that last part when Dennis and I went out on an out-of-body trip together. And this was an experiment that Bob was doing with us one night at the lab. And our instructions from Bob were to meet above the lab, that was up in the air above the lab, like an out-of-body. We'd go up there and meet and then stay together. And we each had a microphone hanging from the ceiling just an inch above our lips. And as we had this experience, we were relaying to Bob what it is we were seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling, you know, what was there. And Dennis and I, while we were out of body, were talking to each other. We were having conversations. And anyway, he had a microphone on me and a microphone on Dennis, and we were in separate booths, separate little sonically or acoustically isolated chambers, such that if either one of us had screamed as loud as we could, the other one probably couldn't have heard it. And we were talking very, very softly into this mic. So at the end, Bob, it was a fairly long trip, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, we were doing this. And then when we came out, Bob ran the tape, Dennis's tape. There were two separate tapes that were being recorded, one from Dennis, one from me, audio tapes. So he started them both at the beginning, flipped the switch, turned them both on at the same time so that you could hear on this tape, me asking Dennis a question and him answering it, and vice versa. We were having conversations back and forth of these two separate tapes that were made for each of us. And like I say, we were acoustically isolated. Actually, my booth that I was in was also electromagnetically isolated. It was in a Faraday cage, so there wasn't any electromagnetic signals getting out between us either. So that is when it hit me at the emotional level. And after that, I no longer asked, is this real? That was just no longer a question that was reasonable to ask. But up until I got it at the emotional level, I was always asking, is this real? You know, what's really going on here? Are we just somehow fooling ourselves somehow? And after that, I didn't have to say that anymore, because there was no other explanation for that other than the fact that we were both together in this non-physical space, because otherwise we couldn't have heard each other. Like I say, even if we were shouting, we couldn't have heard each other. And here we are having conversations, seeing things, going places, meeting people. A lot of evidential stuff happened, and it was all there. And we were both there, and that was rather, it was so obvious that you couldn't come to any other conclusion. And that hit me hard. It probably took me about 2 weeks to deal with that. It was sort of my God, you know, this is real. And I kept saying that over and over, because it was a rather large, you know, pill to swallow. It was before, it was just kind of theoretical. But after that, it wasn't anymore. So I continued to do research. I would go in these out-of-body states, and I would collect evidence, And then I would do that again, except I would do it by changing a variable. I'd say, well, I do it differently this time. And does it make any difference? And if it did, then I'd have some little information. This make, you know, this variable makes a difference. That variable doesn't. How much difference does it make? So then I'd have to go through a bunch more. So it basically took me 35 years of doing this exploration, changing one variable at a time, trying to figure out what made what work and what were the limitations and what you could and couldn't do and why. And I, by the end of about 35 years of that, I thought I understood how consciousness worked. And at that point, I wrote my books. I wrote this trilogy, and I wrote them primarily as a theory of consciousness. And that's because one of the facts that I had gained through this research was that consciousness is fundamental. And the physical reality, what we call our physical universe, is not fundamental. That's clear because I could do things in the non-physical that changed the physical, but you couldn't do it the other way around. You couldn't change things in the physical that then modified the non-physical. So it was obvious that the non-physical, the consciousness, was fundamental. And it was the superset, if you will, and that the physical universe was the subset, was not fundamental. It was derived from consciousness. So I knew that the physical reality was derived from consciousness, but I had no idea how that worked, or, you know, how you start with consciousness and end up with the physical reality. That was, I knew it must be that way from the theory and what I had learned from the facts I'd learned from consciousness. But it wasn't until about 2 years after I had published this trilogy, this theory of consciousness, that it came to me, you know, one of these aha moments, sorts of things, that the very same ideas and concepts that explain consciousness also perfectly explained quantum mechanics. And that was a big wow, you know. Oh, I can explain quantum mechanics, because physicists can't explain quantum mechanics. They say quantum mechanics is just weird science and it's unexplainable. Well, if you understand consciousness, then quantum mechanics is not weird science. It's a logical science like any other. And if you know what all the inputs are and the logic of the process, you can tell the outputs and you don't have to do the math. All you have to do is do the logic. So anyhow, that was really a big thing. And I thought, well, gee, if I can understand quantum physics, what about the other big science, relativity? Does consciousness inform me about why relativity works the way it does? And that only took about an hour to figure that one out. That one was easy. Yes, I could explain the basic secret, the basic unknown in relativity, which is the fundamental core of relativity. It's the fact that makes relativity relativity, and that is that the speed of light is always a constant. No matter how fast the source of that light is, the speed of light is always a constant. And that was an obvious fact derived from this theory of consciousness as well. So then I started looking for other kinds of, what do we call them, paradoxes, things that are unknown in science and other things. You know, and I found lots of paradoxes. There are several in quantum mechanics, and all of those I could understand perfectly. There's paradoxes, you know, in philosophy, like, go back to Plato's cave with the shadows on the wall. You know, that was what was called idealism versus realism. And that paradox has gone through the ages and been discussed and fought over, you know, since Plato's time. So, you know, a couple of thousand years, more like 2,500 years, that idea has been, and this provided a solution to that. There's the Zeno's paradox that was both out of the Greek philosophy and also a quantum event called Zeno's paradox, and that was explained. Things like neuroscience, perception, qualia, those were all explained. So as I started to work through the world of science, I found that all of these unknown paradoxes, which are just things we know are true, but we don't know why they're true. See, we know the speed of light's constant, but we just don't have any idea why that ought to be that way, because nothing else is that way. Everything else, velocities add. If you're in a car going, you know, 20 miles an hour, and you put your hand out the window and throw a ball 10 miles an hour in the direction the car's going, then relative to the ground, the ball is going 20 plus the 10, 20 that the car gives it plus the 10 that you give it, and the ball is now going 30 miles an hour relative to the ground. Velocities add. Not so with light. Doesn't matter how fast the source of the light is. Light always goes at exactly the same speed. So that was obvious as well from this consciousness theory. So then I looked at other sorts of sciences, and all these paradoxes just fell out. So that gave me a lot of a warm feeling that the theory was a good one. You know, theories are only as good as that they're able to explain things. It's not like a theory is perfect and the theory proves this and that. Theories provide evidence. They provide ways of looking at things. And if a theory can explain all the facts you know, like the speed of light's a constant and that, the physical reality is a subset of consciousness. If those facts can be explained with a theory, then that's good. So if every fact that is known can be explained, then it's a good theory. If it only explains part of the facts, like relativity only explains part of the facts, and quantum mechanics only explains part of the facts, then you know that they're incomplete, that those theories aren't universal. They're not toast, theories of everything, that there's something else above them, some other higher order understanding from which they are both derived. And this understanding turned out to be consciousness. Consciousness is what is above them. So that's kind of in a nutshell what the my big toe theory is. It's a theory of consciousness that turned out to be a theory of everything. And I have not yet found things that it does not explain. So I've been trying. Theories have to always be open and grow. A theory is not a done thing. It shouldn't be. It should always be open for change. If you find something that doesn't explain, then that means the theory needs to be adjusted or changed or thrown out. It means it's not, you know, it's not the biggest theory. So I've been looking for that, and for some years, even the, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, there was a thing called chaos theory, and that was one of the big aha moments in science that we've had in the last 100 years was chaos theory. And sure enough, this consciousness facts, they also explain why chaos theory works the way it does.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the amazing thing. You proved, together with your colleague at the Monroe Institute, or the Monroe Laboratories, I think how they were called by the time, that out-of-body experiences actually work, which cannot be explained with a material worldview. So you did something very similar to what people did in the 1920s when they performed the double slit experiment. It also couldn't be explained. But you didn't do what most physicists do, because they then just go, well, okay, that's just weird science. Okay, let's just, you know, put that in that cupboard here and lock it up and never look at it again. No, you said, okay, and that what is so amazing to me. You said, okay, obviously physics is not complete. It cannot explain those things. So we have to expand physics, and your theory at the end is a physical theory, which can also, which you are now also, as far as I understand, in the process of falsification. So you defined a couple of variations of the quantum, of the double slit experiment, more specifically the quantum eraser experiment, which we maybe get to in this interview today, that where you made predictions, and those predictions might come true, then your theory is at least not wrong. Or they won't come true, then, and that's also what I really love about your theory and about your work, is then you simply say, well, then my theory either isn't correct or has to be, or parts of it aren't correct. So you are open to changes. You're not saying that's it, that's how things work, people, just look at it, study it, and you know, and just go with it. This is an ongoing process, and it's amazing. And
well, that's just the way science works.
I know, but it's not
good science. Just needs to work that way. I mean, it's not. You know, there are. It used to be back in Newton's time that there were laws. You know, Newton had laws: first law, second law, third law, and so on. But that doesn't work like that anymore, because physicists realize that theory is open-ended. You never know what you're going to learn 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now. So thinking that, well, I know it all, you know, this will never change, I know everything that can be known about this, that's just arrogance. You know,
it's a bit silly.
That's not good science at all. No. Good science is, well, here's what we got so far, and it answers more of the questions than anything else, but you know, what doesn't it answer? And, you know, you have to go through it like that. A theory has to always be open to change.
Yes. There's one, a lot of questions already in the chat. I'll pick out one, which seems to be quite interesting. Which part of neuroscience would Tom recommend for studying consciousness in our modern science? Many question marks. Or is science too far away from being able to say something about consciousness? So do you think that neurosciences could evolve to explain consciousness? Or
yes, matter of fact, there is one neuroscientist, a very smart fellow, got his degrees in both information science, I think, and in neuroscience at MIT, I believe. So he's one of the heavy hitters. His name is Dr. Donald Hoffman, Hoffman, and he has come to the conclusion, and he is doing mathematical modeling to represent his conclusion. So he's creating a mathematical model of this, that this physical reality, as he describes it, is like the graphical user interface on your computer. It's not real, that there is a reality at a much deeper level. Just like with your computer, when you take a Word document and you grab it, you know, with your mouse by clicking on it, and you drag it and then you drop it in a folder, those are just metaphors. There's something going on deeper than that, something at the bottom level is changing ones and zeros, you know, in memory someplace. But you don't have to deal with that reality. You just have these metaphors that are out on the surface of clicking on a little blob on your screen and dragging it over to another blob and letting it go. And he says that's the way our physical reality is. It's just a set of metaphors, just like a user interface. It's our user interface. And he has very strong evidence coming from neuroscience of why that has to be the case, why that's the only logical solution to the neuroscience problem of qualia and consciousness. So he has basically said the same thing I have, that this is a virtual reality. The reality is not this hard physical thing you think it is. Well, Buddha, 2,500 years ago, came to the same conclusion too. He said reality was an illusion. So yes, so in neuroscience, I'd go look at Donald Hoffman and look at his math and his model, and that will show you where neuroscience will take you if you are very logical. If you follow the logic, then you end up with Hoffman, because he has a very good mind. He's a math and computer science guy besides a neuroscience guy, which is a nice combination.
Yeah, it seems to be perfect, and it indeed matches what you're saying. So what you're doing basically is you're presenting a digital systems view of reality, and you say that we are individual subsets of digital consciousness. Now, what does that all mean? So maybe just to lay out your theory, I mean, in the time we have.
Okay, we'll probably have to work at this with layers. I'll answer some questions, I'll throw it back to you, and you can ask more, and in layers we'll finally dig down to the bottom of it, because just to start and do the whole thing would be a long lecture, and I'd rather have a conversation than give a lecture here. So let me just start it, and you can help.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff in the internet. So I would, anyone who gets turned on by what we discussed tonight, read the book. Read My Big Toe. I have it lying here. It's being translated in German right now, but I hope they catch the humor. I don't know. And there are a lot of lectures. There are the Marseille lectures. I linked up your YouTube channel. So what you can do here today is give an overview, give, so to say, a teaser, and then people have to dig in. That's right. And then,
yeah. It takes a long time. Yeah, when I actually try to give an introduction to My Big Toe theory, it takes me about 2 days. So we're going to do this in 2 hours. We obviously aren't going to get that much detail, but I've got lots of stuff on YouTube, some 650 videos on YouTube. Everything I do, I try to videotape it and put it out on YouTube. So there's lots and lots of talks. So if you're interested, you can find it there. But let's just start. What is your reality? What composes your reality? And if you think about that question, it's, well, you get sense data. What is that sense data? It's just information. Say a photon comes and hits your, bounces off a rose, and then goes into your eye. It gets focused by the lens on the retina. That retina then sends off an electrical signal that goes down your nervous system to the vision part of your brain and starts to rearrange neurons and synapses and that sort of section, patterns of neurons. So what is that rose? What is that red color that you get through that sight, and maybe if you sniff it, that smell, and all the rest of your environment that you hear and see and taste and smell and feel, it's just information. Your reality is nothing more than information, and it's information collected through 5 senses. And you get that information. You get that pattern of neurons. You get those electrical signals, and you interpret those to be this physical world. You interpret that signal and that little twist of neurons, oh, that's a rose, and it's red, and it smells good, and it's growing in my garden, and there's these other things in my garden. So all of that information comes to you. You have to translate that. What does it mean? What is that? Because all you get is just information, data. And the data is discrete. It's not continuous. It comes in terms of photons. It comes in terms of neurons. Comes in terms of little electrical pulses. So pulses and neurons and photons, these are all discrete things. There they are, and now they're not. They come in little chunks. So we call that digital data because it's discrete. Digital basically, it refers to it being in discrete chunks. So saying that your reality is information seems to be pretty obvious. Yes, your reality is information. Take away all the sense data, and what do you have? Just imagine you can't see, hear, feel, taste, smell, anything. What would be your perception? What would be your reality? It would be that you would be aware that you existed. You would be floating in a black void. Floating because you don't feel anything, black because you don't see anything, silent, void. And you would simply be aware of, I exist, I am. Sort of the Descartes moment, I exist, therefore I am. I am, therefore I exist. Those two things mean the same thing. So that's what you would be without getting this data stream that you interpret. Okay, so seeing that our reality is information, that's pretty plausible. Now, let's look at the concept of information-based realities. And physics today is coming to the conclusion that our physical reality is information-based. Okay, quantum mechanics has been pushing us in that direction for almost 100 years. But now so are a lot of other things, you know, including Donald Huffman. You know, there a lot of other things are pushing us to that understanding that our reality is information-based. Well, if we call it information-based, that is the same thing as saying that it can be computed. Okay? If it can be computed, it's information-based, then that is what we call a simulation. If it's a simulation, that is what we call a virtual reality. So I've just gone through a whole bunch of terms that all pretty much mean the same thing, and they're all related. So you end up with this reality being a virtual reality. And that's probably the biggest growing idea in physics over the last, say, decade. It went from almost nobody taking it seriously to it being taken very seriously by the very best scientists. When you see, when you go to the YouTube and you'll see some collection of physicists all talking about virtual reality, when they introduce them, you'll see that they come from you know, from MIT, from Caltech, from CERN, from Planck Institute. It's all the top end institutions that are leading this change, not the ones that follow. Anyway, it's become a concept, an idea that is taken very seriously now. I'd say that probably 25-30% of all the physicists all over the globe think that this being a virtual reality, or I should say an information-based reality, is pretty acceptable.
Wow, 25%.
A lot. I wouldn't say most, but a lot. It's not just a few crazies out on the fringe. It's starting to be understood that that is the only concept that answers the questions. It's the only concept that lets us understand or model what the experiments show us. Nothing else works. For instance, if you go, you know, look at all the little videos that you can get on YouTube around CERN when they were looking for the Higgs boson, there was a lot of interest then, and therefore there were a lot of little videos being put out then. And I was doing that some years back when that was a big thing, and I ran into this little group of physicists, and they were talking to somebody about what they were doing. And one of the comments this group made, they says, "Well, you know, years back we thought that electrons were little chunks of mass with a charge. And that just doesn't work. If you have that idea that it's a little chunk of mass with a charge, you cannot describe or understand the results of the experiments that we do. It just doesn't work. But you can describe our experiments, you can understand them in terms of an electron is a point with the attributes of mass and the attributes of charge. That enables you to get the right answers. Now, what is it? What's the difference between a chunk of mass with a charge? Well, that's a physical thing. A point is not a physical thing, and attributes are not physical things. That's exactly how you would describe an electron that is being modeled in a computer. You would model it as a point with the attributes of charge and the attributes of mass. So things like that have caused physicists to say that the only thing that allows us to understand the results of our experiments is seeing our reality as information-based, as computed, as a virtual reality. But the mass of physics still tries to, you know, fight that. They don't like that because that is saying that materialism is wrong. Materialism doesn't work. Newton's view of the world is a big clockwork, big machine. That is wrong. It doesn't work. And that's very disturbing to most physicists because that's what they, were taught. That's what they grew up believing, that this is a physical reality, that physical reality is the fundamental reality. and that everything else is derived from the physical reality. Consciousness is somehow derived from the brain. Everything has a physical cause. And their science, all their schooling, everything has been based on that foundation. And now for the last 100 years, quantum mechanics has been saying, well, good theory, but it just doesn't work. The world isn't like that. Reality isn't like that. So it's been now 100 years since the double slit experiment pointed that out. And now we are starting to get it, because it's not only the double slit, but a lot of other things are also pointing that out. So science is coming around to this idea that this is a virtual reality. And you hear that being discussed now as a sane idea, rather than just some kind of crazy thing that people who really don't understand are talking about. It's a serious scientific position now that it's a virtual reality. So anyway, here we are, and if we get rid of our sense data and our interpretation of that data to be this reality, then we're just consciousness, basically. We're consciousness floating in a void, awareness. All right, so let's try to model this process and see what we get. Let's say that this reality is information-based, and it's digital, okay, and that we see it, like I say, with the neurons and the pulses of electricity and so on that make up the information that then we interpret. So if we try to model that, then we say that it's information-based, that consciousness is what's fundamental, and that this is a virtual reality. That's where physics is taking us. All right, so virtual reality, what does that mean? What that means is that what you see is not what you are. A virtual reality game, let's take World of Warcraft or The Sims as an example. That's a virtual reality game. Now, the avatar is the elf or the barbarian or the Sims character. That's the avatar. The player is the consciousness. The player makes all the choices for the avatar. The avatar is just information, just a shell, just enough to let you see how your choices are playing out and how they're interacting with others. There's nothing there. So your elf in World of Warcraft doesn't have to have lungs and oxygen to breathe and that sort of thing. It's just a pretty picture for you to look at so you can see what's your avatar is doing and how it's interacting. Is it winning the fight or losing the fight? You know, you get that kind of information back. But that's all there is. So the consciousness is making all the choices for the avatar. Now, let's look at what that means logically. Logically, that means that if you're inside the virtual reality, if you're in that virtual reality, if you're the elf, then there's two things that must be true. The computer that's computing your virtual reality has to be someplace else. It can't come from inside the virtual reality. The computer computing your virtual reality has to be non-physical from the point of view inside the virtual reality. Second thing is that the player cannot be inside the virtual reality with the elf. The player has to be non-physical with respect to the viewpoint inside the virtual reality. So both the computer and the consciousness doing the choice making has to be outside of the virtual reality, and they both have to appear non-physical from the perspective of the virtual reality. So if that is just the nature of virtual reality. A virtual reality has avatars and has players. You can't have a virtual reality that's different than that. Virtual reality has avatars and has players. Players make the choices. Now, here we are. If we're in this virtual reality and our body is the avatar, if this physical universe is a virtual reality, that makes our body the avatar. And that we would have to say from our viewpoint in this physical reality that the computer computing it has to be non-physical to us, and that the player playing it, making our choices, has to be non-physical to us. So the player is our consciousness. Our consciousness has to be non-physical to us. That's the player. But the player and the computer have to be in the same reality frame. They can't be in two different reality frames because the player and the computer are constantly trading information back and forth. So they need to be in the same reality frame so they can trade that information back and forth. All right. So that means that the computer is also in consciousness. That tells us that we have our fundamental reality, we have consciousness. And that I call that the larger consciousness system. Part of that consciousness is configured to be a computer because consciousness is an information system. See, we established that in the beginning. What is our awareness? What is our consciousness? What is our reality? It's information. So consciousness is an information system. And part of it is configured as the computer, and a subset of that larger conscious system is also configured as the player. Okay, so the player and the computer are both subsets of consciousness. Now, why would that be that way? Okay, that is kind of the next question. If we get to that point, then we've already established then that we are avatars. This is a virtual reality. Now, I'm just telling you the theory, the logic of the theory. We're avatars. We live in a virtual reality. Our physical universe is a virtual reality. We are being played, us, when I say, who am I? I am really the consciousness. I'm the player. I'm not the avatar. I'm not the body. I'm the player. Okay? And the player is non-physical to me. It's consciousness. The computer is non-physical to me, and that's consciousness. Really, the player and the computer are just trading information. This virtual reality is just eye candy, just like it is in our virtual reality games. Okay, so that kind of is point one. Okay, point two is why would a system of consciousness go to all this trouble? I mean, what's the point? Why would this naturally have to develop? Because you can't just make stuff up like this and say, oh, well, that's the way the world is. Why? Well, because it is. You know, that doesn't fly. You need to know why it has to be that way, and there is no other logical choice. So let's take consciousness at the very simplest level. What is consciousness if we reduce it to the minimalist, simplest thing that we can reduce it to? Well, it is an awareness that can be aware that it is in one of two states. That's the simple thing. It's just an awareness, a self-awareness, if you will, that's aware of itself and that it can be this way or that way. That's the simplest form of consciousness. After that, consciousness evolves. It can just evolve. Well, if it can be this way or that way, that's like it can be a one or a zero. You know, if you want to put it in computer terms, it can be binary. It's a one or a zero. And then it can be in a one state, and then a zero, and then a one, and then a zero, and then a one, and then a one, and then a zero. So it can be in different sorts of states in different sequences. Okay. And if it can be in one of those two states, then it can be in one of three states or four states. Evolution tends to let it grow. Now, how does that information system evolve? Information is order. Okay, there's another measure of order in physics called entropy. Entropy is a term that is really a measure of disorder. So if you have high entropy, you have a lot of disorder, and you have low entropy, you have very little disorder, which means you have a lot of order. So if all of the bits in a potential system are random, there is no information, no order. If those bits are ordered, then that is information. Now, information can even be in a pattern. You know, it can be, you know, up, down, up, down, up, down. What's next? Can you predict? Well, it's going to be up because we've got a series of ups following downs. Excuse me. So, let's see. Let me get a little cough drop here to keep that from happening anymore.
Yeah, it's the season, right. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So, so we have information and it's digital, and it's aware. So consciousness comes into this theory as an assumption. Consciousness exists. In its smallest form, it's basically an awareness that can discern two states. It starts evolving. So how does consciousness evolve? It evolves to lower entropy. In other words, it tries whatever it can try, whether that's just random or not, and the things that lower its entropy produce more order, and order can come in many forms. It's not only order in structure, but it's also order in meaning. So it can produce things that are significant to itself, that have meaning to itself, that are symbolic of other things, such as language or mathematics. And it has to lower entropy. So it makes patterns of ones and zeros. And then it makes patterns of patterns and patterns of patterns of patterns. And all of this is lowering its entropy. Consciousness is evolving. Okay, now it does that, and eventually it slows down its evolution, because just patterns of patterns gets to the point that you're not getting anything new. So it had a technological invention that gave it another dimension called regular time. And all it had to do to get regular time is take two of these states, the one and the zero, the this and the that, and just oscillate back and forth, 1 0 1 0 1 0, and that defines a metronome and starts to define regular time. Now it can have sequences of patterns and so on. It gives another whole dimension in which it can organize things, create order. So then it evolves that way until it again begins to slow down its evolution. This time, the strategy it uses is that it can split apart itself and interact with that part. Now, all the parts have free will. So let me go back to this free will suddenly jumped in there. Where did that come from? Well, if you have consciousness, you must have time and you must have free will. excuse me again. Consciousness is awareness. Consciousness is choice. Okay? An awareness that does nothing is really not conscious. If it just sits there as a potential, but is not really aware of anything, can't make any choices, then it's dysfunctional. That's not what we think of when we talk about conscious. We have awareness that makes choices. If you can make a choice, then there has to be a before the choice and after the choice. Or if you can be aware of more than one thing, then it's, I'm aware of this, now I'm aware of that. So it was what I was aware of before and what I'm aware of now. You see? So awareness and choice require time. Now, also, choice requires free will. If there is no free will, then there is no choice. I mean, that's the whole point of determinism. There's no free will, there's determinism. And if there's determinism, there is no such thing as choice. Choice doesn't exist.
And so consciousness doesn't exist. And consciousness doesn't exist if there's no choice, because what's the point?
Exactly. So that's the thing. We have these two opposite corners that are that are incompatible with each other. In one corner, there is consciousness, time, and free will. All things that logically must exist for each other to exist. You can't have any of those without getting all of them. In the other corner, you have materialism and determinism. Okay, now if you are into materialism and determinism and you're also logical, you will have to come to the conclusion that there is no time, there is no consciousness, and there is no free will. Because determinism locks out free will. Without free will, there's no choice. Without choice, there's no consciousness. All right? So these are opposite things. Free will, consciousness, and time. And on the opposite side is materialism and determinism. So those two things, you can't pick and choose between those. Some people say, well, I'm a materialist and I believe this is a solid physical place, but I also believe in free will and that there's time. You can do that, but it's just illogical. You can't do that and remain logical. So because we do have consciousness, then that's a pretty good, we are conscious, at least some of us are conscious some of the time. We think that we also have time and we have to have free will. So here we are with this monolithic consciousness that's got now sequences of patterns of patterns of patterns of sequences, and it needs to find another dimension in which it can find new ways to create order, new ways to create information, because that's how it grows. And I might add here that, you either evolve or you de-evolve. If you're an information system, you either lower your entropy or you're going to increase your entropy. You can't, for a long time, just stay between the two, stay even. Because as you increase entropy, that makes it easier to increase entropy more. And as you decrease entropy, that makes it easier to decrease entropy more. Those two things tend to be driven in whatever direction you go. The system's kind of driven in that direction. So the system has this imperative to evolve or die. And when it dies, if you're an information system, death is total randomness. There is no information. That's kind of the final death of an information system. If you are evolving, then your information, your information is more structured, more useful, more significant. And as you can make it useful and significant, then that gives that more meaning, and all of that lowers the entropy, and you are evolving. Evolution requires effort. If the consciousness system doesn't do anything, that information system I'm calling the larger conscious system, does not do any work, but doesn't do anything in order to keep itself ordered and growing, then it will begin to fall apart. No work, then things just normally come apart. Second law of thermodynamics. You have to constantly put in effort in. So we have this monolithic system now, and what it does is it breaks itself apart into what I call individuated units of consciousness. Now, it still has a large part of the system that we'll call the operating system that's still there. But we have these subsets of consciousness, individuated units of consciousness. They all have free will, and they're going to interact with each other. Now, when you have things with free will interacting, the possibilities of what can come out of that are huge. Just huge. So if you have thousands and tens of thousands and millions of things with free will interacting, the potential is almost infinite. It's huge of what you might be able to build with all of that, what you might be able to build with all of that cooperation, with all of that, warring with each other, whatever. There's lots of ways that all of those individual units of consciousness can interact with each other. And some of those ways have low entropy, and some of those ways have higher entropy. So we have these individuated units of consciousness, and their job is to interact in ways that lower the entropy, right? So the whole system evolves. That's the whole reason for creating them in the first place, is that the system's evolution, its lowering of entropy, was starting to stall out because it was limited just with sequences and patterns. And offs and ons. So now with these individuated units of consciousness interacting with each other's free will, there seems to be no limit anymore. There's still patterns and sequences, but they are lost in this huge soup of potentiality that all these IUOCs, individuated units of consciousness, can create. So that went on for a while. And interactions took place, but basically they took place in something that we could model with like a big chat room. What does consciousness do? It creates information. It shares information. It sends information. It receives information. Then it can decide what it's going to do with that information and send out something else. So it's like a real big chat room without rules. And this is actually the first virtual reality. A virtual reality is basically defined by a rule set that sets up the interactions that can take place. It defines the interactions that can take place. So this big chat room was a virtual reality, and the rule set were the communication protocols so that these individuated units of consciousness could communicate with each other. Well, in a big chat room, there's just not a lot of consequential action going on. There's not a lot of consequences to your behavior or to what you do or to what you create and what you send and receive. There's very few consequences. So evolution was slow. It was working. It was chugging along, but it was very slow. What was needed was a virtual reality that had a lot stronger, more meaningful rule set, because the rules define interactions. The rules create the context within which interactions can take place. So what the system did is it created a more complex virtual reality than just the communication protocols, and it came up with a set of initial conditions and a rule set. And someone hit the run button in this consciousness, part of consciousness configured as a computer, and these initial conditions began to change and interact with each other according to this rule set. And that is how you create a virtual reality. You let the virtual reality evolve from initial conditions and a rule set. And no doubt the system tried to do this many, many millions of times before it finally came up with a rule set and a set of initial conditions that would create a virtual reality that was going to be useful for individuated units of consciousness to interact in. A reality, a virtual reality with a lot more consequences, a lot more significance in its decision-making and in its choices. Well, let's say that that initial conditions is a ball of plasma under very high temperature, very high pressure, as we all understand from Big Bang theory. Those are the initial conditions, and the rule set is what we call science. Okay, it's all the physics and chemistry and biology. It's all the facts. That's what science does. It digs out the rules that are in the rule set. As it understands the rule set, it understands how this world works. That's what science is all about. So after lots and lots of evolution, a set of initial conditions evolves along with a rule set such that when the run button is hit, that that ball of gas expands, it cools, suns form, planets form, so on and so on and so on until we get our solar system, Earth, and us. Okay, we all evolve out of that. And now the system has, at least in this one instance, it has a set of avatars. It has evolved a set of avatars. And consciousness now can log on to these avatars and experience what the avatars do and how the avatars interact with each other according to the rule set. So they can experience the life of the avatar. Just like when you log on to World of Warcraft, you get to experience what your elf does. Your elf runs, it fights, it swims, it does all these things, and you, the player, are making the choices, but it's the avatar that's doing it. And your experience is the avatar's experience. Okay, so that's why consciousness would want to create a virtual reality. So I'm just giving you the logic of why it is that it would develop this way. It's not just that poof, out of the blue, there's this virtual reality, and consciousness is the computer and the player. But it was necessary. It was necessary to evolve something like this in order for consciousness to continue evolving and to pick up the pace of its evolution to find more and more complex states. Now, if you look at this this thing that has evolved, you see that it has done the same thing. And that's because evolution is a process fractal. Okay, now you know what geometric fractals are. You take a little geometric shape, a little geometric equation, a little line or something, and you keep adding the same thing to the same thing. So let's say you take a triangle, and now you put triangles on that triangle, and then you take all of that and build up another triangle out of that. And then you put triangles on those triangles, and you just keep adding triangles to triangles by cycling through, you know, what do you call it, recursively going through this equation and different levels, different scales, and you end up with a geometric fractal. And you know, geometric fractals, though they start with a very simple rule set, can create...
Uh-oh, I think you're gone again. Oh yeah, there we go again, but normally it should come back. People are asking if I'm still here. Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening to Tom.
Are we back?
Yeah, we're back. Hi, Tom.
Okay, good. All right, so you know the geometric fractals are fractals that can make beautiful, complex pictures that go on and on forever. There is no end to them. They can just keep on iterating to something that just gets bigger and bigger and more complex. Well, that's the same sort of thing that a process fractal does, except instead of iterating on a geometrical equation, it iterates on a process. Now, evolution is a process fractal. So what that means is it iterates. The process of evolution takes place, which changes things. Now, that changed condition is fed into the input of that process, and it changes it some more. And that output is turned around and fed back into the input of that process, and evolution changes it some more. So evolution is a process fractal. And what happens is, through this process fractal of evolution, you end up with very, very complex and complicated things at the end, just because you've run around and round and round through this process called evolution many, many, many times. And as in any fractal, fundamental processes repeat themselves. Fundamental results and changes repeat themselves. So what happened with cells? We start with a cell, a single cell. And we had maybe lots of things with a single cell, like an amoeba. And eventually, those amoebas learn to split and work together. They learn to cooperate with other single-celled things, and they made multi-celled things. And through that cooperation, the multi-celled thing had a lower entropy, and it was more flexible, more survivable, because it had more things that it could do. It was a more complex entity. And then those multi-celled things cooperated in ways that they specialized. So now you had a larger thing that had organs and special things like eyes and stomachs and feet and teeth, all sorts of specialty parts that made the whole thing a lot more complex and more ordered. Therefore, it lowered entropy and it was more survivable because it had more things that it could do. It had more potential, you see. So that is the same process. You start with a thing, and then you iterate on that, and it keeps growing and getting lower entropy and more and more complex. So in that same way, you have this virtual reality being created with the initial conditions and the simulation, and it just keeps evolving. And through this engine of evolution, it's creating this process fractal that we call our physical universe. And it is hugely complex and huge in its size. It can continue to grow. It is a fractal. It's a big process fractal. All right, so that's the physical world. It's created. It's out of a simulation. It's a virtual reality. We are the players. Our bodies are the avatars. So that kind of gets us to the fundamentals of this model. Now, all of the things that I've told you are all metaphors. I'm not saying that this is the way the world is. I'm saying that this is a model that comes up with explanations of what we see and what we measure and what we find out in our experiments. it explains these things. It explains the relativity. It explains the quantum mechanics. It explains the world. And it explains everything objective and everything subjective. So it explains the out of body. It explains the remote viewing, precognition, telepathy, intuition.
But also but also the hard problems of the so-called hard problems of physics.
Hard problems of physics. All those. It explains both the objective world, which is physics, chemistry, biology, and it explains the subjective world, which is things that are within consciousness, within the mind, that are all subjective. So it explains all of those things. It explains even why it is that any one individual now feels unhappy, that their life is a struggle, and that they can't seem to ever really get ahead. And it explains why they're like that. Or if maybe their life is full of joy and full of happiness, it explains that too. It explains that the things that happen to you, in your dreams, and why you're having them, and what the point is. So it explains all things that are subjective, just like it explains all things that are objective. So it explains both sides. That's why I call it a big toe. A little toe would just explain the physics, biology, chemistry part with one big overarching idea and concept. Well, I've done that, but I also have explained the subjective part and all of it in just as much detail. And that makes it a big toe. It explains everything, subjective and objective. It comes up with a rational reason why things are exactly the way they are. So now I guess it would be a good place for me to say that there is a part of this theory that is just science, good science. And as you said, I have some quantum mechanics experiments out there now that will lend strong evidence for this theory. And I suspect in another few months we'll have results from the first one of those. There's separate experiments.
That was a question that I had, because I'm very curious, very, very curious. What will be the result of those experiments?
Yeah. Well, I'm very curious too. This is science, the science, the experiments tell us what the facts are. You see, theory is just theory, but experiments, well done experiments, tell us what the facts are. So I've got these experiments, and they're being done in a real good institution out in California, a technical institution out there that's going to do them. They've been working on setting up the equipment for a couple of months. And
great! So the ball is rolling. So you're setting up.
I got a contract with a university. That university is working on them. It's a year long contract. They're only a couple of months into it. But it's moving. They're buying equipment. They're setting it up. And hopefully in some months, I was hopeful that it would have been some months ago. But, these things tend to move slowly. Besides, these guys are professors and, they have students and they have classes and they have homework and to grade. And they've got a lot of other things to do. Research is something they do also, but it's not the only thing they do. So it takes a little time. When you're in an academic environment, things move slowly. So it's going to be some months yet, but yes, they are being done right now as we speak. And I will give the results of those however they come out. If they come out the way I think they will, then that will be a lot of evidence for my theory. If they come out otherwise, then that will tell me, that I don't understand what I thought I understood about how consciousness informs quantum mechanics. So anyway, I'll learn something and I will take the theory and see if I can't move it on. If I can't, then it'll just mean that the theory wasn't as good a theory as I thought it was. So that all of that is good information to know. This is just science. I'm not selling anything here. I'm just
not a belief system we're talking about here. This is, as you say, it's hard science, and there are experiments that you set up where you make predictions on how the quantum eraser experiments variants will behave depending on when you erase the which way information and so on. And yeah, it's very, very exciting. So
yes, it is. Now, some of my predictions are very crossways with what quantum mechanics says. They say, nah, that won't happen. And I say, I think it will. So we'll find out. You know, that's the whole point of doing the experiment. Experiments are where truth is.
Oh, boy.
So this is just a theory, and the theory is made up of metaphors. So this thing I call the larger consciousness system, that's my metaphor for this thing that evolves, makes choices, is the information that defines our reality, inside and outside, objective and subjective. So that's what it is. Now, this individuated unit of consciousness is a metaphor for that part of this reality that interacts with other individuated units of consciousness in order to lower the entropy even more. And there's another thing I call a free will awareness unit, which is the thing that acts, that part of that IUOC that's partitioned off from that IUOC that actually logs on to the avatar and has the avatar's experience. So all of these things are just metaphors that describe functions within a model of consciousness that have to exist in order to get what it is we measure out on the other end. You see? So I had this set of facts that I created. Now, they're my facts because I created them by exploring consciousness. This is what I started out talking about. So I spent 35 years exploring consciousness, and in that time, I came up with a whole set of facts that I was able to come up with. Now, facts have to be validated. These facts aren't just things I make up and they sound good and they seem to work in my theory. These are things I had to do. I had to change variables. I had to make sure that they were facts. So I had these facts, and then I had all the facts that I had learned as a physicist about how that world works. And then I wanted to come up with a model that would explain both sets of facts. The facts of consciousness of the 35 years exploring consciousness and the facts of physics. I spent another 35 years doing physics. So that's where this model comes from. Basically, it's made up out of metaphors and logical processes that have to occur if you want to explain all these facts. So that's really the basis of the model. And that's how any model's made. Models are things that people make up in order to explain the facts that they know. And a model can only be judged on how well does it explain the facts. Everything we know, can it make predictions of things that we don't know yet, but it can make predictions, and it has to tell us about things that we don't know yet. See, even if we can't do the experiment to make the prediction. So it needs to be able to explain everything, past, present, and future. And in as much as it can do that, then it's a really good model. In as much as it can't do that, it's a poor model. So quantum mechanics is a good model, but there's a lot of things quantum mechanics can't explain. It and relativity have problems with each other. They have philosophical basic problems. Relativity has an assumption that is denied in quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics holds one of its assumptions that makes it work that is denied in relativity theory. So they have some incompatibility. That's why Einstein and others knew that there had to be a bigger thing out there, a bigger thing from which both relativity and quantum mechanics could be derived. That's why Einstein spent the last 24 years of his life coming up with this toe. But it was just a little toe. Yeah, my toe has to cover all those facts, plus it has to cover all the facts of our subjective world. And if you think about it, the subjective world is really more important, or at least as important, if not more important, than the objective world. The objective world is like the stage, the props. The subjective world is where all the real stuff goes on. That's where love is. That's where relationships are. That's where, interactions between people.
That's where most of our choices.
Yeah. That's where justice is. That's where truth is. That's all in this subjective world over here. The objective world is the stuff. Yeah, it's the trees and the rocks and the cars and it's all the stuff. But the stuff isn't really the most important part of our lives. That subjective part is really more important. And this model talks about that. So the physics part of this model is just probably the smaller piece of it. The more significant piece is how it explains the subjective world, because we don't really have a model that explains that. And, you know, this does explain it in detail.
I mean, Einstein didn't do what you did. He didn't have out-of-body experiences. As someone told me once that Einstein was invited to seances and stuff like that, but he didn't go. He said, if people find out about that, I have to answer a lot of funny questions. So he stayed away from that.
Right.
And you didn't. I mean, you were thrown in as a five-year-old by entities. By the way, someone asked years ago in the chat, do you know who these entities were that were in contact with you?
Yes, and some of them I'm still in contact with today.
Wow.
Some of them I found out I've been in contact with them for more than this lifetime, which brings us to another point. Another logical point here, and that is that if we are individuated units of consciousness and we are playing in this virtual reality, which is really an entropy reduction trainer for individuated units of consciousness, okay, then our goal is to lower our entropy. And the only way we can do that is by changing ourselves and who we are. So this is a point I haven't made yet, and it's a very important point. And that is, all right, I've got us up logically to this in this model that we have a lot of individuated units of consciousness interacting with each other, and that their mission is to lower entropy. Well, when you have a lot of individuated units of consciousness interacting, you have a social system. And when you have a social system, how do you best lower entropy? Okay. So we already had the one-on-one everywhere, which was the chat room. But now we have the social system. We have interaction. We have a social system. Now, take two groups. I'm going to give a kind of a little comparison here. Let's take two groups of individuated units of consciousness. And in group A, we'll call that the love group. And in group A, there'll be, 100,000 IUOCs. And they all have a certain amount of resources, and they're given a certain amount of stuff to work with in a virtual reality. And their idea is just to go and evolve. And then in group B, we have the fear-based group, because fear is the opposite of love. And in the fear-based group, we have the same number of the same quality, and they have the same environment and the same resources, and we let both groups just go. Okay? Now, over on the love side, everybody cares about everybody else. Everybody wants to help the whole. Everybody is cooperative with each other to see what they can build together. And if somebody comes up with a good idea, well, they share it. If somebody sees an advantage, they share it. And they will eventually optimize their resources with themselves. Whatever talents and abilities they have, they'll end up optimizing all of that together in one optimal system. Okay, now over here on the fear side, we have a problem. On the fear side, people aren't going to cooperate because they think that everybody else is going to get their stuff and they would like to have everybody else's stuff. They can't have trust because if you fear, then you don't trust what you fear. So they can't trust each other. They're not going to cooperate very much. Each one's going to try to get as much as they can for themselves and figure out how can they keep it, how can they hold it. Well, in the beginning, those that are stronger will just take away from those that are weaker. You know, that's the law of the jungle, right? The big ones beat up the little ones. Eventually, the little ones will band together into groups so that the big ones can't beat them up anymore. And then the others will group up in groups. And now you're going to have all these little groups that are mutual defense packs, if you will. But they're also, once you have power for defense, you also have power for offense. So you build up a big group, you can go take things away from smaller groups. It's right back to where it was in the first place, except now it's with groups. And eventually you end up with a culture that is a bunch of warlords running groups. You have a lot of hierarchy. The very few at the top own almost everything, and everybody at the bottom does most all the work.
That's where we are now, yeah?
That's where we are now. That describes our reality, right? You see? So in a social – what the point of this is that in a social system, the way you optimize lowering entropy is by cooperation. You don't get cooperation without caring. Okay, so cooperation, caring. Those are the ideas that get people to cooperate and work for each other, to do things together, to make it work good for everyone. Okay, and on the other side, where there's fear, you have a high entropy solution, where if somebody has a good idea, well, they keep it for themselves because they might be able to, you know, to barter that with something else that they need. If they find a better way or a shortcut, they'll keep it to themselves because that's power for them. It's us, me against the whole, which turns into, once they group up in warlords, it's us against everyone else. So one of them is a high entropy. That's the fear group. And that fear group can never build up so much, because as soon as it builds up and gets a couple of things that are looking really good, well, a lot of others are going to band together to tear that down. For one, they don't have it, and they'd like to take it over themselves. So they just can't build past a certain point, whereas the cooperative group can just keep going till they optimize. So that's the difference. So what do we learn from that? What we learn is that in a social group, love is the low entropy process. Fear is the high entropy process. So that tells us, what are we supposed to do here? We're supposed to be in this, play in this virtual reality, and we're supposed to lower entropy for the system, for ourselves and for the system. And how do we do that? By becoming love, by caring about other, by being cooperative, by sharing, by helping each other. That's how we optimize. Now look at those cells, the single cell, the multi-cells, the other cells. You can look, you know, the complex cells with organs. Remember, we went through that evolution. Look at that. What we're seeing there is various levels of cooperation that's lowering that entropy, where cells can cooperate, where the heart part and the liver part and the feet part and the teeth part all do their part. And because they all do their part, and not one of them is saying, I'm better than the rest, you know, I deserve more, they all get what they need to do their part. And they're all working together. Well, that's on a cellular level. Now, we here in this virtual reality are doing the same thing, but we're not cells that are all going to bond each other shoulder to shoulder. We're all going to remain individuals, but we can create something out of our group, out of our society, that is much greater than any of us individually. So we're going to create another thing that's greater than us because of our cooperation, and that's our part in this same fractal process of evolution. So we're going to do the same thing the cells did, and now we humans are going to have to learn how to cooperate and care and help each other, and that's lowering our entropy. Then the world becomes a kinder, gentler place, and it becomes more effective and more efficient, more ordered, and entropy decreases. So that's where we're going, and that's why we're here. We're in this virtual reality trainer, this entropy reduction trainer, in order to learn how to care, to love, to cooperate, to not be so self-centered. That's our mission. And that means the only way to do that is by changing ourselves. It's not that we need to learn how to act better. We have to learn how to be better. There's a difference. And changing who you are isn't something you can do quickly. So there's this accumulative function in this individuated unit of consciousness, because it's going to play a lot of different characters. It's like the same thing when you're playing World of Warcraft. You play your player, and then your player gets killed, gets run over by some big monster. And now what do? You don't quit, go try to find some other game to play. You get another character. And you play, and now you're a little smarter. You understand the game a little better, so you can get a little further before you get killed. And then you go back, and you go through lots and lots of elves or barbarians or whatever you are. And each time, you will learn a little more about how to play the game. And you accumulate strength. You accumulate hit points, whatever. That means you're growing up. You're cooperating. You're understanding. So that's the way our game works. We're here, but we can't learn it significantly just once. And we are individuated units of consciousness that exist forever. We're immortal as consciousness. So we're trying to grow up. So we log on, we play a character, that character dies. You know, we log on to another character and that character dies and so on. So, you know, that's called reincarnation. I just call it experience packets. We do experience packets because that is a logical consequence of this theory. It's required. Otherwise, the simulator won't do us any good, because if it's a one-shot thing, we'll never get anywhere, because you just can't change yourself at that fundamental level where you become more cooperative and caring. You can maybe change your behavior, but that's not what it takes. You have to change it fundamentally in who you are. So you're required then to have these multiple experience packets. So that's kind of the logic of it. And I've just skidded across the top. You know, like I say, it would take me 2 full days to explain all this in detail. So we're just flying across the top here, but that's the essence of the model: who we are, why we're here, what our purpose is. If you look at this model and you say, well, why are people unhappy and they're struggling and they can't seem to get, you know, to where they're going, and if I just get over this next hurdle, everything's going to be great, and then there's always another hurdle after that, it's because they have high entropy. It's because they have self-centeredness. It's because they have fear.
Ego.
And ego, that fear creates ego, and it creates beliefs. You know, that's another one of my sayings: believe nothing, you know. Be a good scientist, believe nothing. But also be open-minded and skeptical. You should be very open-minded, otherwise you'll miss things that are important. And you need to be very skeptical of everything. And the person you need to be most skeptical about is yourself. So
that your beliefs.
Your beliefs. Because if it's not your experience, it's not your truth. So if you take on and say, well, I've heard this and I read these books, so I believe such and such, well, you shouldn't believe such and such. If it's not your experience, it's not your truth. Your truth has to be based on your experience. Otherwise, it's somebody else's truth. It's the truth of the people that wrote those books, not yours. So you have to be careful not to pick up baggage out of your culture, because there are cultural beliefs, things we just believe just because we're born in our culture, things we believe just because we're human. There's a lot of beliefs we have, and they're all dysfunctional. You need to get rid of all that stuff.
Yeah.
So that's it in a nutshell.
That's it, but it's a huge theory, and people have to look it up. And as I said, and I often get a lot of flack for interrupting my guests so often. Well, I didn't interrupt you now, because this needs to be laid out. And of course, there are lots of questions. I don't know. Do we have time for a couple of them? Or
sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's one that is, it just came in now, and it's really interesting. It's by a listener. And he says, how stupid is this? If you optimize for maximum order, lower entropy, what you end up with is just perfect order, like in a perfect crystal structure where nothing happens anymore, ever.
Yeah, no, not the case. That's what you end up in a crystal, because in a crystal, you only have a certain number of possibilities. And that is if all the little, molecules just line up just so. And when they're all lined up, you're done. Okay, so that's a very limited system. So in that system, yes, you can get to the optimal entropy point and you're done. Okay, in a system with 7.5 billion, at least that's how many of us are on this planet, with 7.5 billion individuated units of consciousness, all with free will interacting to each other, the potential is way beyond that. The potential is so big that you don't end up in a place where there's no place else to go. Yes, theoretically, you could get to a point where every possibility had been investigated and every possibility had been filled out, and you found the optimum thing, and it would be static after that. But that's assuming that you don't have new stuff coming in at the bottom. You see, we have new IUOCs coming every time another baby's born, and the population of this planet goes up by one. That's the new IUOC. So you don't have this limited set of N molecules that, if they line up properly, minimize their entropy and you're done. That's a very simple picture. the bigger picture of us is so huge and has so much potential, and there's so many various ways that we can interact with each other and things that we can do that, you know, you always have something else to do. Let's say you happen to grow up and you're very grown up. Well, it's not like, well, I'm grown up, so I'm out of this game. No, it's like if you're grown up, that means you care about others. If you care about others, you're back in this game as a teacher, as a helper, as a good example, because that's what you want to do because you care, you see. So you never personally or as a system are going to run out of anything. There's always new coming in at the bottom that has to start, you know, from wherever it is. And if you, let's say, get to that point where you are completely grown up, let's say you're perfect, you're just a being of love, all right? If you quit there, you will immediately begin to start to de-evolve because you're no longer putting work in. You have to constantly put in effort to maintain that. You don't just get there and stop. Now, a crystal gets to a certain point where everything is stable and it's a low energy state in that crystalline form, and it just stays there, you see. But consciousness is not like that. Consciousness is not a crystal. That's a physical thing. Physical things have very discrete limitations. Consciousness gets to a point where it was perfect. It would still have to keep working, be helping others, be contributing. Otherwise, it wouldn't stay perfect. It would stay there and stay there feeling better and bigger and smarter and more perfect than everybody else, which is ego. And oops, it slipped already. Yeah. You see, it would start de-evolving.
Well, so, I think what the listener maybe left out here is consciousness. So, I mean, this, and we haven't even talked about absolute unbound oneness and absolute unbound multitude yet, which is this big thing that was there at the beginning, and it was conscious. So, and you also say that there are only, so your theory basically is based on two things. Consciousness exists and evolution exists, and everything else more or less then is derived from those two things by logical reasoning, which is which is brilliant, I have to say. And so there is a consciousness there, and a consciousness with free will, and that's something different than, I mean, I understand the listener's question. If it's just about lowering entropy of some digital system, you could just fill it with zeros, for example. It would be very low entropy, but there would be nothing there. And that's...
Right. That's why content and meaning is important, you see. That would be low entropy just as far as filling it up with an object, but it wouldn't have any meaning, wouldn't have any significance. So if you can arrange those things in a way that they have... You know, we're talking about order. And this order now is in order, ordered ideas, ordered concepts, concepts with meaning. So it's not just physically placing things all in a row. It's what is the significance of those things? You see, we're now talking about the entropy of consciousness, not just the entropy of a box of rocks or the entropy of a bunch of ones and zeros where you could, make all zeros. Well, that's all ordered. Fine. But so what? You know, there's no meaning or significance to it. So, all right, you lowered entropy, but you lowered it just this tiny little bit by making them all zeros. So it's not that big a deal. It's a tiny little increase in entropy. But if you can take those ones and zeros and start making a computer program out of them that does something really useful, now that's order that's meaningful, you see? And even if you did that all with just 1,000 ones and zeros, then you're going to lower that entropy a whole lot more than if you got a billion ones and zeros and just lined them all up, you know, 1010 in perfect order, because that wouldn't have any significance to it. So it's more than just physically lining things up and structure. It's also about meaning and content and significance. See, this is consciousness. Consciousness makes choices. It's the quality of those choices is what matters. And that's where you're going to get massive decreases in entropy of the consciousness. So his problem is he's taking entropy as it applies to a physical thing and saying that's the same as entropy as it applies to a consciousness. Well, they're two different things. Entropy can only be defined within a system. If somebody says, the word entropy, the next thing would be, of what system? Entropy is only meaningful in terms of a specific system. If that specific system is a bunch of salt that maybe can go into a crystal, well, that's one thing. And now that's that system, and its entropy is, you know, going to change based on whether it's crystalline or not. But if the system is consciousness, and a larger consciousness system with all that potentiality, you see, it's a different picture altogether. Now it's not only the structure of the ones and zeros, that's almost trivial. It's the meaningfulness, the choices that come, and how do those choices evolve this social system into lower entropy configuration. So it's a very different system, and it includes thoughts and concepts, meaningful things, symbols, all of that's important.
Yeah, the listener now writes, I think it's a listener. Okay, but then the goal is not minimum entropy, but something very different. Well, as you said, as far as I understand that, I think it is a very good question, but the definition of entropy has to be adapted to what we are talking about here. So
Yeah, exactly.
So it is something very different.
Entropy gets used in a lot of different ways. You know, there's all sorts of entropy. If you talk about computers and so on, there's Shannon entropy. And if you talk about other things, entropy is just, I'm using it in a very general sense. I'm not trying to use the exact same idea of entropy on a system that's of salt solution as I am with consciousness. You have to think of entropy in terms of its fundamental definition, not its application to a specific system. Fundamentally, entropy is something you can say it in two ways. It is a measure of disorder, or it's a measure of order. Okay. Now there is order in concepts and ideas. It's not just physical arrangements of things, but ideas are ordered. If you come up with a brilliant idea that helps people, get rid of their fears and go off of medication or something, and all it was an idea, it's a concept, and it's things they do, well, that is lower entropy, you see, for the system that has to do with people's health. So concepts and ideas will make things work better. So it's the order, but you have to think of order in a bigger picture order, more general order. That's also another way to describe entropy, is that it enables work. It enables a system to do more, to accomplish more. That's the other side of entropy. You have order, and that order allows a system to do something more than it did when it was high entropy. Well, that's the way applied to consciousness. That's where the idea of the concept goes. You comes up with meaning and significance that really enables the social system to do more that they couldn't have done otherwise. So you see, it is entropy. The word entropy is the right word. You just have to think of it in a larger context from its fundamental ideas of what entropy is and apply those fundamental ideas to consciousness, as opposed to thinking of entropy like as just something to describe a heat engine or a bottle of salt water. It's different systems require you to apply the concepts of entropy in different ways. And there are half a dozen different entropies, if you will. They're all the same entropy, but they're all applied to different systems. And within those systems, they all make sense.
Yeah, so that's something, I mean, you have to wrap your head around slowly. So I also wasn't that aware of, I haven't really thought a lot about entropy. So for me, entropy was just, heat. and apparently that's just a very simple definition of it that applies to our physical universe. Within our rule set, as you described. Another question that I read, and you just tell me whenever you have to run, Tom, because I
okay.
mean,
I'm yeah, go- my next appointment is here, but they will wait just a little bit. They can.
Okay, you just tell me, because we're going to hug you for for a long time.
I'll come back, and we can just do Q&A then, if you like.
Yeah, I guess we definitely have to do another show. So I mean, but okay, let me get one more question. because it is so, that just pops into mind to everyone who first gets confronted with your theory, of course. And that's also, you also talk about the risks that are in your work. And I mean, one of the risks, if you want to see it as a risk, is, okay, the question, well, who's the programmer? Who created this virtual reality?
Yeah, well, that's the answer, is the larger consciousness system. You know, that's the thing that evolved from the this way, that way.
Exactly.
It evolved up to a larger consciousness system, and it didn't program it. There is no programmer. It evolved a rule set and a set of initial conditions, and then it let this virtual reality evolve. So it's not a programmed reality. It's an evolved reality. And how did it come up with that rule set and those initial conditions? Trial and error. It evolved those as well. You see, evolution is at the engine of all of the piece parts besides the whole thing. So, and it's, it's this process fractal. So there is no programmer. And here's something. You've heard of the anthropic principle, where physicists say there are, a half a dozen constants. And if you changed any one of those constants, even in the 10th decimal place, the whole universe would collapse. It just wouldn't work. So because these constants have to be so precise for everything to just balance here in our physical world and not crumble, then it looks like that these constants were generated just for us, because here we are. You see, it's called the anthropic principle. Well, why is it that we have these constants that have to be tuned so well to make this physical universe stable? Well, you have this rule set and you have these initial conditions. So you put them together and you hit the run button, and after a while, boom, it all falls apart. Oh, okay, we're going to need to tighten up gravity a little bit. Crank that up. All right, big digital bang, run two. And that goes, and it goes a little further, and so on. So it evolves over probably millions of tries of trial and error to get all the pieces of that rule set just fine-tuned so it'll produce something that lasts long enough for consciousness to use it as a entropy reduction trainer for consciousness. So that's why we end up with this anthropic principle, with all these constants right out the 8 and 10 decimal places having to be exactly what they are. It's because that was evolved that way. The system evolved. So it's not like somebody just sat down and programmed it and now you have the master programmer. It doesn't work that way. It's an evolved thing. It all started with that consciousness that could only differentiate this way and that way. And everything else then is a deductive, logical thing to get you from that to answering all the questions that are both in the objective and subjective world. All the questions, I mean, all the facts that we know.
Yeah, but the danger, of course, is that religious people come and say, oh, so you call it larger consciousness system, that's nice, I call it God.
Yes, and they do.
I mean, there are a lot of parallels, obviously.
Yes, there are a lot of parallels. Matter of fact, I was surprised. I was very surprised when a lady wrote me an email. This is some years back. And she says, I am a very religious person. I take religion very seriously. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, this isn't going to be good. And the next line says, and everywhere I go, I take two books with me. One's the Bible and the other one's My Big Toe. And I just about fell out of my chair. But I've gotten that a lot, you see. This theory is very inclusive. It's widely acceptable because it defines a common unified understanding. You see, you got Buddha, the mystical traditions. They can find themselves in here. You got the Eckhart Tolle self-help personal development. They can find themselves in here. You got Niels Bohr, Albert Einstein, John Wheeler, all the kind of modern physicists, and they can find themselves in here. And for example, you get an atheist and a theist. You say, well, they're absolutely opposite each other, an atheist and a theist. But both can find in My Big Toe a logical system that explains and supports their views. So the theist says, the larger conscious system, that's God. And the atheist says, look, there's no God. There's just this evolved consciousness system. You see? So they both, it serves everybody. It's a logical thing. It's not just a God that came from nowhere it's an evolved thing. Logical, the larger conscious system evolved from just the definition of what consciousness is. Now, I do bring in, I do start with consciousness. And that's maybe a thing to talk about, because I start with the assumption that consciousness exists. Well, and I do that because no one can go back further than that. You cannot evolve nothing into consciousness. You can do some hand waving and get there. Matter of fact, you can find that in the philosophy department of Stanford University. If you go to philosophy and look up cellular automata, you will see an argument there of how you can take, it's not nothing, it's potential, and turn it into something like consciousness. They have that argument. But the point is that we are consciousness. And because we are consciousness, it is logically impossible for us to see the birth of consciousness. You see, we're it. We can't get outside of it to look at it objectively. We couldn't stand there and watch it being born. So there's no way for us to get firsthand information about the origins of consciousness. We can get some hand waving and some conjecture, but we can't ever get there because we're it. We are the system. We already exist. It's like you cannot watch yourself being born. You know, you can watch your younger sibling being born, but you can't watch yourself being born because you haven't been born yet. It's that sort of a logic. So you have to start with an assumption, or you have to start with some hand-waving conjecture about cellular automata and the fact that if you have potential, just randomness can eventually build structure out of potential. And there's another body of mathematics that gives the probabilities of all that happening and so on. And given the billions of years, it's quite feasible for things to be created just out of potential. That is also evolution.
And every big toe, that's also what you say in your book, must at least have one mystical leg to stand on. And that's exactly that. So it's
yes.
The beginning is a mystery, as you say. We cannot.
Well, it is.
Yeah.
And right. Well, ask a physicist about the Big Bang and say, well, where did that ball of plasma come from? Because our universe didn't exist.
Yeah. But
the physical universe that we call physical reality did not exist until after that big ball started to expand. So where did that big ball of plasma come from? Well, it's outside of our universe. It had to come before our universe. So it's a mystery. You know, that's something mystical. Where did that first cell come from for the biologists? Give them a cell and they will take it and evolve all the rest of the plants and animals, but they have to start with an assumption that there was a cell. You have to start from the assumption there was a ball of plasma, and then you can go forward. It's the same, it's the same sort of thing. You end up, you don't always end up in an infinite regression of causality. You just get to the point that you say, I don't know. I'm consciousness. I won't know. I can't know where consciousness came from. I can guess and I can make conjectures, but I can't know.
But as you say, physics more or less ends at or starts with the Big Bang, and no one within our physical model, our prevalent, which, you know, the mainstream physical model, can talk about what was before the Big Bang or anything. But
right, they can't.
In your theory, you can explain it.
Yeah, no, I can explain that where the Big Bang came from, right? It's because it's a big digital bang.
Yeah.
And it was necessary, that was the initial conditions required to go with the rule set that allowed a stable virtual reality to develop.
So someone started... Yeah, someone simply started the simulation. That's the Big Bang. There you go.
Right.
And yeah. So, I mean, but so you can go back much, much further than mainstream physics. But
right. That's because the physical world is not fundamental, you see. But you can't do that with consciousness because consciousness is fundamental. It's what we are. So you can't go back and explain that by standing outside of it. You see, I'm standing outside of the physical universe and saying, okay, there's this big computer, a rule set, and a set of initial conditions. But I have to stand outside of physical reality to say that, you know, to make that thing. Well, I can do that because physical reality is not fundamental. But consciousness is fundamental. So with consciousness, there's nowhere to go to stand outside of consciousness to say that because we are consciousness. So that's the difference. So I could explain where that ball of plasma came from. Yes, that's one of the big mysteries that this model explains. Yeah, it's just a set of initial conditions and a rule set, and they were evolved to work, to produce something that is stable enough to serve the purpose.
And just to give another example, you also have a very surprising answer to the mind-matter problem. Answer, there is no matter. It's just rules that define matter, and we as a consciousness then perceive of it and then call it matter. I mean, we could call it whatever.
Oh. Yeah, the scientists get real hard on things like they don't like this idea of not knowing where that ball of plasma comes from, and they realize that's a failure, that they're starting with really a mystical beginning with, oh, it just was there. You know, that's mystical. There's no cause for it. It was just there. But look at all of the fundamentals of physics. Look at time. Physicists don't know where time comes from. Look at space. They don't know where space comes from. What about spin? They don't know where spin comes from. Gravity. They don't know where gravity comes from. If you look at all of the basics of physics, all the things that all the rest of the physics is built on, they're all mystical. There's no causality for any of them. What's the causality for time? What's the causality for space? What's the causality for gravity? What's the causality for any of these things?
Yeah.
Any of the basic fundamental things. Charge. What's the causality for charge? Oh, charge, it just exists. And it's got this smallest unit, which, you know, is 1E, you know, so we can define it and then we can do the math and work with it. But everything that lies at the foundation of physics basically has no cause. It's mystical. Things without causes are mystical, you see. So physics that doesn't like mysticism is based on it at the foundation everywhere you look. It just deals with it. Say, okay, we don't know where any of those things came from. They just are. But we can take all those things and we can model this physical world. Well, yes, they can. They can dig out nuggets of the rule set that models this physical world. So physicists being real harsh about people who have, you know, a mystical leg to stand on, they don't realize that they've got a whole bunch of mystical legs that prop up physics.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah. Well, okay, I mean, for example, the question about time, that's one of those questions that I had for myself, and there are tons of questions that people had, but I start to feel a little bit bad about your next date, so...
Yeah, I'm gonna go. Yeah. I will make one comment, though, that all those things I said, like charge and space and time and gravity and all those things, because those are things of the physical world, I can explain all those. I can say where space comes from. I can say where time comes from, where charge comes from. All of those things are obvious answers once you get to a virtual reality. You see, it's just like I can say where that ball of plasma comes from. So I solve all of those mysteries. All of those mystical foundation of physics suddenly becomes known if you take this viewpoint of virtual reality. You can explain all of those. You know, why C a constant? Well, because in a virtual reality, as fast as you can move contiguously through a virtual reality is 1 delta X for every delta T. You can't move any faster than that in a simulation. you've got a simulation, and the dynamic driver is a delta T that gets incremented, and there's a delta X, which is like your smallest pixel, if you will, call that a 3D pixel, and you can only move one pixel for each clock cycle of the computer. So nothing can get faster than that. You see, so every virtual reality has a speed limit. Our virtual reality speed limit is the speed of light. So that's easy. So solved.
Not necessarily. Like,
Where does space come from? Easy. You take a point, you call that the origin, define three mutually orthogonal unit vectors from that point, and that defines space. Now you can calculate everything is in space you want. That's what defines space. That's how 3D space is created. You can create as much of it as you like. All you need is a computer that can handle bigger and bigger numbers. So gravity and space and time and all these things are obvious. Time, what's that? Well, it's the outer time loop in your simulation. That's the time basis of this virtual reality. So all these things that physicists have that are mystical all fall out as describable from the next level up. So the point is, if you want to understand how quantum physics works, you have to find a different perspective. We've been forcing the perspective of materialism on all science, and that's why we've been stuck. And that's why quantum mechanics has been not logical, but weird science, because we want to force materialism and determinism on it, and that's not how it works. So once you let go of that determinism, materialism, then suddenly consciousness, time, and free will can pop into view, and now you have explanations for everything.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I had troubles getting my head around is, could it really be that simple? Because it, in a way, once you get into this paradigm of well, this is a simulation, things do fall in place, but it almost seems to be too simple. But then again, yeah, if it works, well, who gives a whatever?
Yes, but if you go back to fundamentals of physics, you will find that, and Einstein and others have repeated it, but it's a well-known fundamental of physics, and that is, if it's fundamental, it will be both elegant and simple. Mm. Anything that's fundamental, and we're talking about the most fundamental thing at all, the fundamentals of our existence, any explanation of something that is fundamental must be both elegant and simple. And that turns into a little downstream in the logic, that turns into the Occam's razor, which says if you've got something that is complicated and has multiple assumptions and so on, and that's your model, it's a poor model if it's modeling something fundamental. So Occam's razor says the simplest and most elegant solution is more likely to be the true solution. And you're right. When you look at this virtual reality idea, it is so simple. It makes all these things that are really complex and mysterious and big mysteries, they just are trivial. It's just obvious. Okay, speed of light's constant. Of course it's a constant.
Yeah.
You can only move one pixel of distance for every pixel of time. Yes, of course you have pixels of time and pixels of distance. It's a digital simulation. You see, it all just fits. So that's the thing. Yes, it's very, very simple. Once you understand it and get your mind out of perpetually thinking in terms of materialism and physical reality and start seeing it from this perspective, it's just breathtaking how simple everything gets and how you end up with a deductive, logical explanation of everything, including your attitude, including how you feel, the quality of your life, yeah, everything.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Well, on that note, I'm going to bow out because my next meeting is patiently waiting for me for 20 minutes, and I really need to not keep them waiting.
Well, thank you for your next thank you to your next meeting that he or she waited. Sorry that we kept him or her waiting, and thank you so much for this interview. I would very much definitely like to do a Q&A session, at least one. And please keep watching out for my emails. I'll put CropFM in the subject line, and okay. I'll send you, maybe in December we can do it, 20th of December something. But I'll send you an email with that, and it just okay. would be great if we could continue our conversation.
Good. Now, if I don't answer your email right away, send me another one, because I get about 300-400 email every day.
Oh, my God.
And sometimes stuff just gets lost in the tangle, and I get so far behind that I just cut a whole lot of it lost. So if you don't hear from me for a few days, then send again. It's not that I don't want to respond. It's just that things tend to get lost.
I don't
want to
spam you, though, but okay, I will. Okay. Well, yes, I will do that. Thank you so much for your work, for your inspiration. I mean, this is just huge. And I'm very much looking forward to continue our chat and to get to all those questions that I let those people now digest. And maybe some people already said they're going to buy your books. That's a very good idea. And then let's see what kind of questions they will come up with at our Q&A session. Thank you very much, Tom, and all the best for your work, and I'm very much looking forward to the results of your experiments. I guess they will all be published on the YouTube channel, so I'll keep an eye
published
there.
No matter how they come out, they'll be published just as soon as they get done.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Tom.
So long.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Aus der Vorstadt der Wirklichkeit.
Das nächste Mal CropFM findet erst am 8. November statt, da ich beruflich ziemlich beschäftigt sein werde. Neuer Job und so. Daher wird der Oktober irgendwie flach fallen, leider. Aber im November geht's weiter und danach gibt's ein Feuerwerk an äußerst interessanten Sendungen. Im November jedenfalls am 8. das Lagerfeuer Nummer 3 mit meiner lieben, bezaubernden Co-Moderatorin Sabine Zankolo und euch. Und ihr seid natürlich das Wichtigste bei dem Ganzen, denn eure Lagerfeuergeschichten, auf die sind wir gespannt. Und natürlich, da ist jetzt ein bisschen Zeit, um das Ganze hier zu verdauen. Und dann können wir auch gleich über die heutige Sendung sprechen. Und ich bin sicher, da gibt's viele, viele Fragen, die da bis dann aufgedacht sind, die wir vielleicht ein bisschen unter uns besprechen können. Aber es wird sicher ein weiteres Interview mit Tom geben. Ja, ich bedanke mich bei allen fürs Zuhören. Und fürs Interesse, ich war so richtig aufgeregt heute. Also, ja, war auch für mich irgendwie eine sehr wichtige Sendung. Also, und ich freue mich sehr auf ein Wiederhören am 8. November. Bis dorthin, danke fürs Zuhören und macht es gut. Passing once, passing twice, I wouldn't recognize today.